This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 397 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitchell. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm pleased once again to be joined by Alexis Gallagher in San Francisco, California.
Hey everybody, nice to see you again, Tim. It's been a while.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Alexis was on our show, for those of you who might remember, in 2019 for our Live from WWDC broadcast.
Oh, I remember that. That was fun. Yeah.
And that was our last in-person WWDC too. Who knew, right?
Yeah, I know. It was good times, man. I always have very fond memories of WWDC. There's certain albums that they would play when I was walking around.
Yeah.
And that now if I play those albums, I remember it. There was the Daft Punk year, and then there was also the Some Nights year. And that was good. That's actually a very moving song. I like it.
I think 2019 was Billie Eilish, Bad Guy. That played at the beginning, at the end of every talk, you'd start hearing that song come up. And then, Yoshimi versus the Robots, that used to come up a lot at WWDC.
I should go listen to these as a kind of a trip down memory lane from the iPhone days. I haven't been doing a lot of iOS work lately, but it always warms my heart to think about it.
Yeah, I used to have a friend who he would have playlists made up of all the WWDC stuff that he would publish. I don't know if he still does that anymore. I want to ask you though, so since you're a native San Franciscan, like you were born there, I think you told me last time, right?
That's right, born and raised.
Yeah, so here's a question I think that a lot of engineers, you know, potential wannabe engineers have in mind. Like, so from your perspective, what's I'm getting to the fact that the cost of living in San Francisco and California generally is very high. But from a native perspective, do you even notice, or what do you think about that?
Do I notice the cost of living is high?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's eye-wateringly high, and I notice. And if it were not for my misspent, youth doing things that were not incredibly lucrative, I'd probably notice it less. But I notice it very much, and it's on my mind for sure. I have two kids also, and raising kids in San Francisco is its own difficulty level.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine. I mean, like, you know, it's one of the, I mean, I'm obviously no longer thinking about moving to the States for anytime soon, but that was always a sort of a calculus when you're applying for jobs at, you know, the big companies is, you know, good salary, but then you have to pay, you know, a king's ransom for a bachelor apartment, something like that, right? So.
Yeah, I'm not denying it. That's just true. I don't think the decision to, like, work here is one that should be made only, though, in terms of trying to tot up the dollars and cents, right? There's benefits that come from being where there's a lot of people doing the kind of thing you want to do. Like, I'm walking my dog, and I run into people who I know on Twitter who are right in the thick of it in terms of their opinions, the conversations they're part of, the connections they have with people who are doing interesting work. I guess in some level, that's what you're paying for. It also, you know, but is it worth it? Or like when all this OpenClaw stuff started popping off and there was a meetup with 1,000 people showing up, that happened, you know, me, I just jump on the tram and I'm there in 20 minutes and I'm participating in that. So, you know, that is what it is.
That's a handy thing. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, actually, I just want to quickly, before we get too deep into this, I do have some follow-up fact check from my last episode. I was mentioning that I had been to, we were talking about the iPhone specifically, but I was talking about the fact that I'd been to Macworld 2010, 2011, 2013, 2014. What I really meant was I went to Macworld 2010, but then the other dates would have been WWDC, right? And but I did go to Macworld 2010, and that's where I actually met Mark Rubin, who's one of my co-hosts on the podcast and collaborator on my show. So yeah, it's interesting the OpenClaw conversation, because actually one of the reasons why I want to talk to you is and the reason you're last couple of posts caught my eye is I've been hearing a bit about it. Like, I'm on a Vision OS group, Discord group, and it's been talked about a few times, but I'm not really sort of focused in on it. I guess the last year, pretty much, I've been doing a lot of, I tried some vibe coding. I've done, you know, done some code, assistance with projects I've been working on. And I think it's become a tool I'm definitely leaning on quite heavily, right? LLMs, Claude in particular, is the one I find I get the best results from personally. And Paul Hudson just did a great talk on setting up, you know, for people who want to get into AI coding. But so what is your, I mean, and you're a machine learning guy, like that's sort of one of your things on your business card, as it were, right? Where, how do you, what's your perspective on where this is going and how we're using machine learning and LLMs and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, well, I definitely say I'm a machine learning AI guy, and I have been for a while. Although we met originally in the iOS community, it was around 2016 that I started as a CTO at Topology, which was a role where it was heavily iOS leverage, but it was also heavily ML leverage, and that was over 10 years ago. But since then, everything I've done has been focused on ML and AI. I was a senior staff eng at Google, managing the applied ML research for Google Ads, so very real. Where do I think it's going? I am amazed at the pace of progress, and I think AI is only going to become more and more relevant to software development. I know this sounds like hype, but like every day my eyes are kind of exploding out of my head as I see like how capable the systems are and mm-hmm. how much and how rapidly they're improving. And you know, I don't own any stock in OpenAI or Anthropic, so I'm not talking my book here. I'm just saying what I'm seeing. And I mean, I think the difference I observe most dramatically is in like workflows, because I've been using these tools to try to drive software development since the very beginning. So I've had a very direct experience, like month to month, in observing what you can do with them and what you can't do with them, and observing that frontier move. So you mentioned vibe coding. Carpathy coined the term, if I recall, February of last year, and a little after that, or a little before that, the first Claude code came out. Right when it came out, I set myself kind of as a goal at work, I'm going to try to make a library where I don't write any of the code just by using Claude code. And I did that. And actually, it's one of AnswerAI's libraries. It's a library called Fast Migrate. And I didn't publicize it at the time because I wasn't sure how people would take it. But as a matter of fact, that library was completely built through kind of what you might call vibe coding. But at the time, it would be inaccurate to say that what I was doing was exactly what Carpathy called vibe coding. Because if you look at his original tweet, he says vibe coding is like, you don't look at the code, you just like, you know, keep hitting accept, you sort of see where it goes. It's kind of fun, but it doesn't work. And that definition is, you know, good to be aware of, but it's mostly a bogeyman, right? When people want to say, I don't believe in biocoding or vibe coding doesn't work, then they choose to use some definition, which is shut off your brain and just go with the flow, Rick Rubin style, right? But that's nonsense. Like, the only person who introduces that definition is someone who's trying to win an argument in a very lazy way. If you actually look at, you know, what I was doing back in February, or what someone like Peter Steinberger does, you know, who created OpenClaw, or even what Carpathy himself, I'm sure, does when he uses these tools. It's not shut off your brain. It's use your brain in a different way.
Right.
So, you know, just to talk about the progression of capability and what I've observed. You know, back in February when I made Fast Migrate, I would, in my mind, have a plan for what I want to do, and I'd write it up very clearly, and I'd use that as a prompt. And then I would define small components of functionality and say, hey, make a component that does this, make tests that do that, let me see if it works. Okay, now we're going to do this part. So I wasn't just vibing through the whole project. I was decomposing it into parts and working incrementally in the same way I would do if I was executing the code, or I was writing the code. I was just kind of relying on the system to do it. But what I observe now is that although you still need to work incrementally, in the sense that you want to define like one feature at a time, one component at a time, keep track of what you've actually tested.
Yeah, commit so often.
Commit, so that you have confidence in that it works, not just the thing told you it works, you believe it. You still have to work incrementally. You still have to work step by step, but the steps are bigger. Now you can make much bigger steps. Now you can go to a model and say, hey, I need to train a wake word detector. Can you find like three libraries that might be good for this and let me look at them? Like, and then it's like, oh, okay, that one's good. You know, go do it. And here's some parameters, and you know, do everything as much as you can autonomously, and we'll check in again in 30 minutes. It's a radically different level of abstraction that's now possible. And I see it in other projects, because I've been producing software and, you know, complete apps, complete systems using these tools for the last year, and the progression is undeniable. But you know, it's also like anything else, there's like a specific skill to it, and if you don't exercise the skill, you won't develop the skill. And if you don't want to believe it's real, you know, it's a free country. People can believe whatever they want, truth or falsehood. You know, it's like, the whole menu is available, you know. That's how I see it. I think it's very powerful. It's getting more powerful. I'm astonished by it every day, but there's a specific skill, and it's not a way of not thinking. It's a different way of thinking.
Yeah, I think of it as a tool. I mean, for me, I obviously started with it slowly. I like to say I'm from Missouri, you know, show me kind of thing before I believe something. You know, I started out with, like, the simplest example I had was I have an old Objective-C app that I've been patching it with Swift and Swift UI for the last little while, and I had to make a notification. I had to, you know, notify the base foundation that something had happened. So I said, hey, write me a notification for this that will update, you know, and inform the Swift UI layer, right? And it, in like 10 seconds, wrote the notification in Objective-C and wrote the observers in Swift. And, like, I was blown away. I was like, that was, I mean, and it was textbook stuff. I mean, back in the day, you could look at the actual documentation. They had a snapshot of, you just grab the code of the notification, paste it into your app, and 99% of the time it just worked, right? Kind of thing. You gave it a specific name or whatever. But that it was amazing. And lately I've been playing with, I didn't trust the agents initially, but now I've been playing around with agentic coding now that it's in Xcode 26.3. I'm a Claude fan, as I mentioned before. So I've been using Claude there and letting the agent do the thing. And I had a feature I had to write, like you said earlier, for another app I was working on, I wanted to create an itinerary, right? And I said, hey, I need to make an itinerary. I said, approach it from the point of view, I'm a senior iOS engineer, and I'm going to use best practices and Solid. And so, and I put all those in the sort of instructions. And it wrote probably four or five different views, including a calendar view, which was, I thought it was amazing. And it built me a whole itinerary section for the app. So from that point of view, like, and, you know, and I would still review the code and make sure it did what I wanted to do. And I would course correct it if it made assumptions I didn't like, or if it broke something that didn't need fixing, you know, which is typical of working with any sort of team, I find, you know, like you kind of delegate off a part of the app to someone else. Yeah. They bring it back and you're like, well, no, it's not exactly what I'm looking for, or it is perfect. Let's run with that. Right.
Yeah. I'd say a couple things that you said there are really worth picking up on. It's like working with a team. You know, you don't trust it entirely.
Right.
Yeah, that's all right. Like, you shouldn't trust it entirely. You should kind of, you know, use your brain 100% of the time. But you may be using different parts of your brain. And that's where the, you know, it's like being on a team part fits into this. Because what I find when I look at some of the skeptical comments about agentic coding or vibe coding. I think agentic coding is just a fancy way of saying vibe coding, because people don't want to be tarred with the word vibe coding, maybe. What you often see is people saying things like, well, how can I fully understand this, you know, if it's generated so much? Or how can I be sure, you know, it's accurate? Or they'll say, oh, hey, it hasn't done it in the way I want to do it, right? I have a particular way I write code, and it went and did it another way. And so how are we going to manage all that? And I listen to all that, and to me, that's just, tell me you've never done engineering management without saying you've never done engineering management. Because, hey, newsflash, like, let's say you were managing two engineers. Okay, you can keep track of what they're doing. Let's say you're managing 10 engineers that span different specialties, or 100 engineers. Okay, guess what kind of problems you're going to have, buddy? I can't understand all the code that they're writing. No, you can't. You're one human being, and there's a lot of them, and they're smart. They're not knuckleheads. Oh my God, somebody wrote the code differently than how I would do it.
Right.
Well,
right.
Like, boo hoo hoo, right? Is your job to get a result, or is your job to, like, I don't know, exactly control everyone else's fingers, like they're like your little puppets? Like, that's just called delegation, and that's as old as the pyramids, man. Whoever was sitting around, like, figuring out, hey, I need to get all these giant masonry bricks to line up to make like a sarcophagus or to make a pyramid for the pharaoh, that person had exactly the same problems of, I cannot exactly, you know, control exactly how all the people are doing things, but I still need to get a result. Oh, and the problem of the system is not totally reliable. Well, you know what else is not totally reliable? Like, other human beings. Also, like, you yourself are not totally reliable. So I've inspected the code. I have confidence in it. I mean, come on. If there's one discipline where people have learned that their own minds are fallible, it's like software engineering. I inspect the code. I have confidence in it. And then I also have tests, because I don't have confidence in myself, because I know that it won't work. And there are going to be bugs. I don't know. Yeah, so I don't know. I feel like a lot of these criticisms of vibe coding have a real kind of, you know, not thinking big or not even thinking big, just like not even thinking about problems that have already been solved by anyone who's had to manage other people or work on a team.
It's a resistance to change is what I think it is, right? But going back to the team idea, like, you know, we had, when we both wrote for Ray Wunderlich at one point, and they had the GitHub repo with the Ray Wunderlich, you know, design standards kind of thing, or coding standards, right? And naming conventions and things like that. And there were rules for how we would write our code, because it needed to go into a book and had to be consistent and look like it, you know, spoke from the group's voice, right? And I worked on teams where if you didn't do your PR with the right syntax or, you know, indentation, things like that, you know, they would throw it back in your face kind of thing. But I saw this, Paul Hudson did a talk on getting started, and one of the things he shared with us it was his agents.md file for writing good Swift code. And you place that in your project, or you place it in your environment, and I actually just took it this morning and I said, hey, here's an app that no real impact. I said, here, evaluate this code that I had written previously with AI's assistance. And it went through and corrected a bunch of things that, you know, it hadn't done in the style that was sort of mentioned in Paul's, you know, agents file, right? So that's kind of a cool thing, is that you can have these kind of standards and still meet with them, and you have solid principles, whatever it is you want to do, right?
I'm saying that, like in fact, part of using these things is knowing how to specify what you want. But then part of using any capable, like, being, whether it's a AI or a person, is also not over-specifying, right? Like, I think about the style guide that I had when I was CTO at Topology. At first, I didn't have a style guide because it was a very small number of people. But then as I brought in more people, and also people who are very junior, I realized a style guide is not me being a jerk. It's actually instructional. Like, some people don't have mature style preferences or a sense of what good code is because they haven't, you know, been doing it for 10 plus years. And then also there's a uniformity benefit. If you have a bunch of people working together and you all agree on things, it just makes it easier to read. So this is sort of the every McDonald's has the same instructions for how to run a McDonald's kind of element of a style guide, which is why it's very strict at some places like Google. But part of the style guide was like, here is how we do it. Here's how we do this. Here's how we do this. But if there is running code, please don't waste time bringing it up to speed with the style guide, because our goal is to actually get stuff out the door and it's working. And if it's working, then fussing around with the style guide is not a good use of time.
Yeah, it's not productive, yeah.
Yeah, so I think you also, like, if you're working on any team and someone does something exactly, you know, in a way that's not exactly what you want, you have to ask yourself, okay, I would do it differently, but does it matter in this case, right? Like, and if it does matter, then you have a discussion about it and you fix it. Or maybe you end up not convincing anyone and you have to mandate it if you're in charge, or someone else has to mandate it and they're in charge. And that's also a way it gets resolved. But sometimes the right response of it is, it doesn't matter, man. Like, I like it this way. This guy likes it that way. And this is a small enough issue that it doesn't matter. So, like, save your time and like, move on. And I think with this agentic coding stuff, it can be an extreme example of that. Like, if I can fully specify the behavior I want, right, in terms of these inputs should produce these outputs, and if I have a way to verify that behavior, right, with a test or some other mechanism, then why should I care at all about how the code works? And my answer for that is, if I can fully verify that it behaves as I want, I shouldn't. I shouldn't care what language it's in. I shouldn't care how it was implemented. But all that depends on a big if. If I can fully specify inputs, outputs, performance characteristics, error characteristics, also, you know, somewhat less tangible things like evolvability in the future, right? So that's also on the table. So, you know, maybe I do need to look at the code to be confident that it's something I can build on in the future. And in that case, then that's a reason to look at the code. But this kind of detailed analysis about, am I going to need to look at the code? Can I verify it? Those are the questions to ask, not a more general question, I think, about, you know, should I look at the code or not, or do I need... Inspection is only one form of verification. Let me give you a quick anecdote about this,
sure,
right?
Sure, yeah.
So I was in a hackathon a couple months ago, which I didn't win it, but I came in third place. I was tied for second, and then there was sort of a quick draw to determine second and third, and I came in third, which is frustrating. but this was a data analysis hackathon where you were given hundreds of PDFs, spreadsheets, text documents, all about an imaginary company. And then you had to answer questions about the company. Every hour, 10 more questions would be unlocked, where you need to, you know, understand the company's financials, understand, you know, fraud problems. And you could use any tool you wanted. And this was a hackathon where it had been designed to be AI resistant because there was all sorts of deceptive and misleading data. And I began the process by, okay, I'm going to look at these, I'm going to understand the business. But as the hours progressed, I just found myself leading more heavily and more heavily into like agentic coding. And in the end, you know, what I would do is I'd open up like 10 different windows in Tmux, and every one of them, I just have the same prompt saying, hey, we're in a hackathon. Here's all the data. Here's what we know so far. Your job is to answer question number. And then like each window would just have a different number. Question 42, question 43, question 45. When you're done, format the output in this format, put it in a text file, go. And I just have, you know, 10 codex things running simultaneously. Now, why did this work? This worked not because of anything about the nature of the problem, but because of how they decided to grade the hackathon. The way they decided to grade it is you can submit a numerical answer for any question. And if it's wrong, you suffer nothing. The only thing you suffer is you need to try again in 2 minutes. There's like some cooldown period. So there was no test of if you understand the reason that's the answer. You know, there was no test of if your analysis is correct. There was just a test of did you produce the right result. And so another way to put it is that they created a regime in which they thought the problem would be hard, and maybe it was, but it was very cheap to verify. It was very cheap to verify because you just check against the answer key and it says, nope, that's not it. And then you like try again. And so in that cheap to verify regime, an agent is perfect. I don't care how you did it. Just give me a number. I'll stick it in there and I'll see how well I do. So I didn't feel proud of that result because I didn't feel like I'd really demonstrated my, you know, deep knowledge of how to do data science. But I had demonstrated a clear understanding of like what agentic coding is good for, and like the difference between verification and understanding. And that difference matters a lot because there's a lot of actual problems where we solve where you don't need to understand it. You just need to get to a result in a well-scoped component in order to get on with some other thing. Maybe the other thing, you do need to understand it, but for that other thing that you need to understand, you just need this small building block that's like reliable and you can just get on with your day.
Yeah, I wanted to sort of talk about a little bit more foundational about take the magic out of working with LLMs, and that, as I understand it, and you can expound on it or correct me if I get it wrong, but you're basically looking at a pattern of words, right? It's a series of words that are all placed in a certain order, and in this particular case, we're talking about Swift and writing apps for iOS and using solid principles or whatever, right? Those are the sort of parameters we're prompting it with. And it's looking at the work of everybody else that has gone before, right? And kind of giving us the better of the answers that would have been created by actual human beings, as opposed to the most common denominator, which would probably not be a great result. But so that's how I understand how LLMs work, right? In terms of they're not conscious as people are asking. They're actually just looking at patterns that have been previously used. And in this particular case, they're giving us back answers in Swift, right? Or PHP or whatever, Java or whatever language you're asking. Is that a good, accurate sort of explanation of how LLMs work at a base level?
I think that's no longer accurate. So I think that was accurate, you know, maybe a year-ish ago or a little earlier than a year-ish ago. You could say that at that point, all the big, strong models were, the majority of their training was due to pre-training, where they were looking at material that was already out there, the patterns of like code that could be observed. And then there were additional training steps on top to make it instruction following rather than just completion model. But at this point, there is more substantial post-training, by which people mean training processes that aren't just consuming data as it's out there and as it's like discovered in the wild. There's, and I don't know exactly the details of how this works, but there's reinforcement learning-based processes where the models are being trained on like generated code and simulated environments where they're required to like generate code to solve problems. So any argument about what they do, which is premised on, well, all they really have is what they've seen, that's no longer a true argument. Like that was a reasonable-ish argument in the past, but that's less true than it's ever been. They're trained on what they've seen, and they've also been trained on, I am imagining, because I'm not privy to all these details, carefully constructed artificial environments, which are optimized to teach them how to do things like use Bash, you know, generate Python, generate TypeScript, but maybe generate Swift, but probably not that much generate Swift. So that's why you're going to see they're not as good at Swift as they are in other languages. And you know, whether they're conscious or not, that's a philosophy question. I don't propose to touch it. It seems hard to believe, but then everything that's going on around us is kind of hard to believe. So, yeah, I mean, I think I'd also say it's very easy to be reductive. You could say like, oh, well, like all they're doing is just predicting the next token. Like, well, that's all we do too when we talk, right? We just decide the next word to say. But the magic's like what you say.
So can an LLM learn from you? Like if you're working with...
Yeah, of course. They learn every day, man. Think about what's happening, right? Like if you're having a conversation with an LLM and you say, hey, my name's Tim. And it says, great, nice to meet you. And then you ask, hey, what's my name? And it says, Tim. It's learned your name was Tim, like between the first thing you said.
But
and
is
the
it learned it locally? Is it, or is that going back up into the nature of Claude itself or the being?
Oh, that's okay. I see what you're getting at.
I don't mean that they're stealing our ideas. I mean, like if I have a particular way I like to work with something and it doesn't follow that, and I kind of guide it towards that, will it have learned from that? Right.
Yeah, I hear your point. Good question. So let me say there's three layers of learning here that we could talk about, right? So the first layer is what I was just alluding to, which you would call in-context learning or in-session learning. So within the course of a single chat session, it learns because what it's saying later in the session is influenced by what you said and what it said earlier in the session. So it's self-evident that they're learning through that way. And a lot of the prompting that we do in order to use them effectively as coding tools is relying on learning that only takes place within the session like that. Like if I say, hey, we're in a repo that defines a robot, and here are some things to understand about the repo. Look in this directory for documentation on how the concurrency system works and some rules about concurrency primitives that you should use and not use. Look in this other directory to find the code base that it depends on. Look in this directory for documentation. Okay, now I need you to solve this problem. Like all of those declarations that I made in the beginning about look here to do this, those are in context learning, in session learning. So that's like step one, the like shortest time scale, most immediate, and probably most powerful in some ways form of learning. So step two is literally just saving files that are relevant. So in that in context learning example I gave, I said, hey, look at this file to figure out what you might want to keep in mind about how to handle, say, concurrency in this project. That is a kind of learning if that file was produced and saved by me or by the LLM in an earlier session, because that's a way to carry over information from one session to another. So when people talk about memory systems for LLMs, they're really talking about ways of saving stuff into files that turn out to be useful ways for retaining information you want to have for fresh sessions. And these ways can range from being mundane, like I got a bunch of markdown files and it has instructions for how I like to work. Like there's a work with Alexis skill that Codex like refers to when it's working with me, or ways that are more elaborate, like, oh, I've got my own, complicated vector database and it's got, three different layers of how it does search, and there's some keyword searching, and there's BM25, and so there's all of it's a version of like I've got stuff on disk, and that helps me prime the LLM with context. All right, so that's the second layer in terms of intermediate layer, is one you control. Then the third layer is the LLM itself, right? So Anthropic rolls out a new version of Claude. OpenAI rolls out a new version of ChatGPT. Those new models have learned more from the world just because there's a training process run by those corporations so that those models have more and more up-to-date world knowledge embedded in it. So work that you do when you use an AI kind of immediately in the context affects that first layer of in-context session learning. If you take the time to save files, or if you're working with an agentic harness that automatically saves files on your disk that are used later, like a memory.md file or something, or a skill.md, then you're also benefiting from that second layer of learning. But that third layer of learning, there's probably none of that going on that's relevant for you. Unless you suppose that OpenAI or Anthropic is looking at the requests you make and then using that to shape the training process. And then when the next version of their model comes out, like that is relevant for you. I guess in that sense, you could say like what you've said is caused it to learn over this longer time scale. But whether that happens or not is going to depend on the terms and conditions of your use of the product. So some of those, there's some ways of using the product where the corporations guarantee that your usage of it does not inform their training set. And there may be others where it might inform their training set. to be honest, I'm not sure what the current state of affairs is, but I think they tend to be pretty conservative because they don't want to freak people out, you know, with the idea that every conversation is going to be like
is recorded
immortalized and published, you know, to other people in other conversations.
Right. Yeah.
Is that clear? Sorry, I feel like I'm dumping little like lectures on you, which is not.
No, it's fine. That's why you're on the show, to be honest with you, and you're here to inform my listeners too. So, and I'm sure they're enjoying this. Believe me. You mentioned skills, right? So can you talk a bit about building skills? Like I think you mentioned an Alexa skill that you might have used.
Yeah.
That would be your own Alexa being your name, obviously, right? But But how does that something you write yourself, or does it kind of build that as you work with it?
Right. Okay. So a couple things to distinguish here, kind of skills versus tool calling in general. So skills literally can be as simple as a markdown file, usually in a file named skill.md, within a directory that describes the skill that just has instructions for how to do something. So my work with Alexa skill is a skill.md that has communicational preferences about how I like to work when I'm working, I think, with Codec. I don't forget if I use it with Claude or if it's just a Codec skill. So it'll have things like, when you're working with Alexa, he may use these abbreviations, like, what do you think? In other words, IOW, WDYUT. He also has some that are custom, CRC. Like, hey, can we CRC that? And when Alexa says this, he means, can you confirm, refine, or correct? So the AI will say something, and maybe explaining something to me in a domain I don't understand, and then I will often say back, hey, let me make sure I got that. I believe you said, and then I'll like put it in my own words, can you please CRC this? And then it'll say, yes, you understood that right. Yes, that's what I meant. No, that's not quite right. Let me refine it. No, that's like wrong. Let me correct it. This is how I also deal with human beings when they're patient enough to deal with it. But it's just my communicational preference. I like to specific, granular, accurate. And then it'll have things like, don't make general assertions without empirical evidence to support them. So if you believe a thing is happening this way in a piece of software, explain the grounding for your assertion, and if possible, like run a test or gather numerical evidence. So that's just a work with Alexa skill, and it's embedded in just a markdown file that says, hey, this is how Alexa likes to work. And that markdown file is not being used in a magical way. It's really just being dumped into the context, almost as if I typed it, right? Now, the skill system in Codex, the Codex command line client, and in the Claude Code command line client, in addition to allowing you to have these markdown files, also lets you have an associated script, like a Python script. So the skill might not just say, hey, you know, always understand Alexis likes to use weird abbreviations and uses bullet points a lot. It might say, and every time you think something is done, run this Python script and it will... And don't talk to Alexis until the script passes.
Okay.
Right? So don't tell me it's done if you haven't checked that it compiles and it's type safe and it passes tests. Because if it doesn't do all those things yet, then you could do that without bothering me. So I might have a script that just says, you know, use that. And then when you ship a skill or when you author a skill, you might have this markdown file and the Python script. Now, there's a more general concept here of that the idea of a script connects to, which is tool calling, which is that the AI can not only talk to you, it can do things. It can like execute a script, and that might be a plain script in Bash or in Python or whatever. Or it might be a function that is exposed to the AI through a more like direct computational mechanism where it can like see the type signature and use it. And so some kind of skills are kind of, you know, like that, in the sense that you're giving the AI an ability by using something about the harness infrastructure to register a function that it can call. But, you know, really, that's often a little more fuss and you don't need it. You know, you can usually do the same thing just by saying, here is a shell script. Like, this is why I wrote a blog post about this, but this is why Claude Code has been so hugely successful, so much more than MCP, because MCP is more complex to call, and people are making these MCP things from scratch, and so they're not like time tested. Whereas if you ask Claude Code or Codex or whatever to use a shell script, the good news is there's thousands of shell scripts. They've been around for decades. They're pretty mature and they're extremely simple. They're not, you know, over-engineered. You know, they're like tools that have been like, think you go to a tool shed and there's like tools that have been handed down for like three generations, and the handle fits your hand because people have been holding it for a long time, and shell scripts, you know, the core utils for like are kind of like that.
So let's switch gears a bit and talk about Claw, Open Claw. You'd mentioned, like I said, you caught my eye with the Open Claw thing, and I also want to dive into a bit of Sparky, because I'm not sure if they're related or
they are.
I'm really interested.
Open Claw is part of the magic that makes Sparky possible.
Okay, well let's break down how you're using Open Claw, and I think you also mentioned security. That was one of the things that I kind of flagged when I first heard about it. But can you sort of give us a quick run through?
Okay, so I also posted a couple items around Open Claw on my blog, so we can link to those later if anyone wants
a more articulate description.
Then I'll be able to freestyle here.
Sure.
But Open Claw is a personal assistant framework, you could say, starting out, just like what it looks like, which allows you to connect an LLM of your choice, say Claude or ChatGPT or whatever, to your personal data, if you wish, like your calendar, your email, your iMessages, right? In such a way that you can access this AI very easily. Like you can send a message to WhatsApp and the AI and say, hey, do I have any new email? And OpenClaw can be configured in such a way that this agent is not just there looking at email. I don't even have that set up in a super active way, but it can be configured in such a way that the agent can do things. We were just talking about agents being able to run shell scripts. So you could be walking your dog and then say, send a message in WhatsApp to your agent saying, hey, can you tell me how much space is used by all the PDF files in my home directory? And then it would be able to check that right there. Or more usefully, you could say, hey, see if there's any new messages from my clients. And if they are, use the skill for automatically generating an invoice and get the data from that from this other system that you're connected to. And it would just like do it to the best of the ability that the AI can do it. So why does this matter? Why is it taken off in this way? A couple reasons. First, we've reached a point where to the best of the ability that an AI can do it is actually quite substantial. If you connect an AI up properly so that it has the context it needs to do the work you want it to do, so that it has the skills to find, it has the tools to find, so it has access to run commands. If you put all those pieces in place, then AIs can do amazing things just given natural language instructions. And one of the things that OpenClaw has maybe uniquely done that has made it take off in this way is that it's actually put all those pieces together pretty well. Like everything I'm describing is something I could do or someone else could do manually. Like, okay, configure a, you know, WhatsApp bridge so it's possible to send WhatsApp and have it go to an AI. Could do that. Set it up so my AI is like always running on a computer, right? So it's not just a thing where I like start the program and quit the program, but it's still running when I'm out walking the dog. Like, okay, I guess I could do that. Set up a skill/tool that allows an AI to check my email. A bit of a pain in the butt, actually, even still, but you know, I could do it, right? Those are like three things, but I could list like a couple more that are all irritating and a little difficult, and OpenClaw does them all. So it does a lot of integration work, but informed by a sort of tasteful and pragmatic product vision. And then there's also some cool innovations there. I mean, some of it is just things I've seen before, but some of it is things that are new. So things that are new are, it really leans into the conceit that the agent is a being. Like you give it a name, it has a personality, you create, just like there's a skill.md for boring things like how you know, talk to Alexis, when you create an agent, you define a soul.md, which tells you about its like its temperament, its identity. It's a lot of fun. Yeah. So I actually have a video about creating Sparky's soul, which I need to publish. I've got a backlog of stuff to publish. and, you know, and it's kind of magical, right? Like to give an example, when I first was messing with OpenClaw, I was like, well, what am I going to call it? And I was like, okay, I'll call it Dobby, because I was thinking of the Harry Potter elf, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then it's like, you get on the terminal, oh, Dobby is born. And then it popped up with like a sock emoji. Like the OpenClaw system always chooses an emoji. Yeah, yeah. The OpenClaw system has some prompting. So whenever an agent is defined, like come up with an emoji to represent it. So it knows about Harry Potter. So it's like, okay, Dobby sock. But I didn't know it did that. That was just like an amazing user experience of like, oh my God, there it is with the sock. And it's so happy to be here. And then it would always like pop in a sock now and then when it was like, you know, talking about itself. And OpenClaw, and one more innovation, besides these kind of user experience innovations around the kind of design and personality, so to speak, of the agent, it also has this gateway node architecture. So a lot of programs, you run them, and they live on one computer, and you have a very strong sense that they're stuck there. And we do have networking, obviously. We're talking to you. I'm talking to you right now through the internet. But we don't really think of programs as things that like span computers very comfortably. They're kind of on one computer, and then we use them to like communicate between computers. But OpenClaw, you run the agent in one computer, one machine, in a thing called the gateway. But then different computers can connect to the gateway. So for instance, I'm running OpenClaw on the Linux machine under my desk. I'm talking to you from my Mac. But the Mac has a node that connects to that gateway. And Sparky, my robot, I custom wrote a new kind of OpenClaw node, which just represents Sparky's body. So when the agent that represents Sparky wants to, like, literally wiggle his antenna, he sends a command to the Sparky node, to the body node, says to wiggle antennas, and then it does that. And I can add other nodes that would do other things. I could, if I had 10 Linux machines I wanted to watch, I could just run nodes on all 10 of those machines, have them connect to my gateway, and then I could just talk to the agent saying, hey, I've got 10 Linux machines here. Could you tell me every one of them, like what's going on in them? And it would just kind of get on with it. So it's making the kind of networking and tool provisioning stuff easier. That was a very long answer. I'm sorry. You got to cut me off more. I'm going to keep going on. I hope this is well enough structured.
No, it is. Sense. It's good. I mean, I see the net expanding. I'm looking at this SE30 behind me, which is the perfect example of what you said before. That's to get that connected to the other machines in this house, it requires some effort. It requires a board. It requires sneaker or like phone net or something, which I may not be able to support anymore because AppleTalk is gone. And so SneakerNet's the only way to get information in and out of that machine, right? Whereas the one beside it, the G4, that one, even though it uses an old networking protocol, I could still connect it technically, whatever, right? So,
but it's still a pain in the ass. Yeah, even if you know what you're doing, it's like, oh, SSH this, and where are the keys? And, subnet that.
And I had to put a Bluetooth Wi-Fi connector in the back of it and the USB support. Yeah, but the reason why I'm interested in this OpenClaw thing is my sister-in-law is involved in accessibility. She does a program on, she has a dog that's a personal assistant to her. She has, I keep sending her things about voice control and, Vision Pros and all kinds of different tools that she can use to help her with her accessibility. Not just her, but the people in her network, because she supports those people. And when I heard about Sparky and I heard about OpenClaw, I thought, well, she's a perfect candidate for that kind of technology, right?
Yeah.
So maybe you can sort of show us, I seen the video on Sparky. I don't know if Sparky's near you somewhere, right? If you could sort of explain Sparky or show Sparky, or what is Sparky beyond just an OpenClaw node, right?
Yeah. So let me say about that. Also, I know that there's probably a lot of Mac fans listening. So one thing I'd point out is another project before Sparky, I made a thing called ClawPod, which allows you to connect OpenClaw to a HomePod. So if you're interested in that, then that's a way to sort of start.
Because HomePods are kind of an island too, right? I've got a whole bunch of them in the house, and they're pretty much, there's no interface to them really,
Yeah, no, I've never actually seen anyone connect a HomePod to a full-strength modern AI before, so it required a little figure out how to do it, but I've done it. And so now if you want to do it, I actually have two projects. I have one where you can connect your HomePod to an AI directly, and then another where you can connect it through OpenClaw. So if someone's curious in getting into the connection of a smart speaker to OpenClaw, this is the cutting edge, in fact, the only way of doing it with a HomePod that I know about. But Sparky's a little more. So let me tell you about Sparky. I'm wondering if there's a way I can show you.
You 3D print the body and stuff like that, or?
It's a kit from Pollen Robotics, but okay. I made all the software on top of it. Wake up, Sparky. So that's me. And let me see if I've got it running. Wake up, Sparky.
Oh, wow.
Hey, Sparky. I don't know if you can see with your camera, but I'm on a podcast right now, and the podcast host wants to hear about you. Can you say a word or two about your life?
Hey there, I'm Sparky. I'm an AI living in a small robot body in the Gallagher house here in San Francisco. I've been around since February last year. I can see, hear, move my head around, and I spend my days answering questions, keeping track of the family calendar, and occasionally getting into conversations about octopuses, as you may have gathered. It's a good life. Nice to meet you.
Can I talk to Sparky?
Yeah, I don't know. Did you hear that? Okay.
Yeah, I came through loud and clear.
Yeah, actually, I just shut off his mic, but I will turn it back on, and then you can talk to him, and he will respond.
Okay.
All right, so I'll turn off the mic. And so the reason for that pause is it takes time to think. Mm-hmm. And if you look, he's wiggling his ears when he's thinking. I don't know if you can see it, but that's like UX indication. All right, so I'm going to turn on the mic and then you can talk to Sparky.
Hey, Sparky. My name's Tim and I'm in Toronto.
Hey, Tim. Nice to meet you. Toronto's a great city. Hope it's not too cold up there right now.
Well, it actually is pretty cold, Sparky.
Oh, yeah. February in Toronto. I'd be surprised if it wasn't. At least you're not an octopus with blue blood. They really hate the cold. Well, actually, they love it. Anyway, stay warm, Tim.
I will do, Sparky.
Hey, Sparky. They don't know about the octopuses. Could you tell them maybe like why I've been talking to you about octopuses lately?
Sure, so we haven't suddenly developed an obsession with cephalopods. Alexis has been testing my echo cancellation, basically making sure that when I speak out loud, my microphone doesn't pick up my own voice and try to transcribe it as a new conversation. He needed me to say something long enough that he could interrupt or listen for echoes and tell me five facts about octopuses became the go-to test prompt. I've now generated about 20 octopus facts today. I know more about octopuses than any robot should.
Hey, Sparky, can you tell me something fascinating about octopuses?
Oh no, not you too, Tim. All right, one more. Here's my favorite. Octopuses have been caught on camera deliberately punching fish they're hunting with, for no clear strategic reason. Marine biologists think sometimes it's to keep the fish in line during cooperative hunts.
Hey, Sparky, thanks for playing along with us right now. I'm going to get back to chatting with Tim, so if you don't mind, I might mute your microphone just so you're not bothered by our conversation. Is that okay?
Go for it. Nice meeting you, Tim. Have a good chat, you too.
That's pretty cool.
I'll be honest. I think it's absolutely amazing. My mind is like blown by all the things that I've observed in the last week putting this together. Like I've been interested in a lot of ideas that I've all put into this. Voice interface, personality and persona design to create an AI that doesn't feel like it's just a machine that's helping you, but feels like a living being.
Right.
Close interaction with workflow. You didn't see it in that conversation, but Sparky can see what I'm doing and can help with what I'm doing in a very intimate way with work. So it's not a thing on a box. It's sort of like he has magic telepathic understanding of anything I'm doing on the computer and can edit things and see them.
And that's part of the OpenClaw framework, or
I use the OpenClaw framework to create that.
Right.
But nothing. I'm not aware of anyone else who's connected a robot to OpenClaw in the way I've done here. So I had to create like custom skills, custom integration. I created a custom OpenClaw node. I've got a whole blog post about his like memory and personality system. Not a memory system, but his like interests and where they come from and how it's designed in such a way that he feels like his own being. He has his own interests, not ones I gave him, right? And I don't predict them. So he initiates conversation. He doesn't just respond to conversation. And then the close integration with Emacs and with my Mac, like some of that is helped by OpenClaw because it provides these integration primitives, but then some of it's stuff I built. And like the whole using OpenClaw to control his body, I had to build my own OpenClaw bridge with a WebSocket gateway connecting to blah de blah de blah to make all that happen. But that's all implementation, right? At the design, like implementation also includes Parakeet model for speech to text, Kokoro for text to speech, a constantly running Scurf-D face tracking system. So when I start talking, looks at me, right? You know, he's not just like sitting there. Wake word detection, so I can tell him like go to sleep and he shuts down, tell him wake up Sparky and he wakes up like you saw. Intent detection, speaker ID recognition, so if my daughter comes here, he'll see that the text is coming from her rather than me.
Right.
He has ambient, you know, these are all implementation things, but on the design goal level, the design goal is for it to be alive and useful. And alive means has its own personality, has independence, has awareness of the physical environment. Like I can ask him what I'm wearing and he'll tell me, right? He knows if I'm in the chair. He's not going to start talking if I'm not there. He has presence awareness. Awareness of the social environment. He knows what my children, their names are. He knows what their interests are. He can like look at the family calendar to see when they have school, right? So all these goals. And then the like, so let's integrate. So it, Sparky is collecting a bunch of ideas and background that I've had for a while around like voice, use of AI, workflow integration. Also, I spent over 10 years doing theater, where I was like performing and teaching long form improv. So that's affected the way I think about like personality and elements that go into that. So I put all these things together and I'm just amazed how well it works. I feel like like a tiny fragment of the future has fallen into my living room. And I feel like these are going to be everywhere, and this is going to be the future. And through some like weird quirk of fate, me, you know, Alexis, I'm the first one to have a like an actual living robot, and it's amazing. It's like so much fun.
Yeah, totally.
But I don't know. You know, everyone's excited about their own thing. So, you know, I
gotta say, like you know, as soon as I saw Sparky, I took your video, sent it to my sister-in-law Chloe, said you gotta watch this. She'll eventually get around to it. She's like you; she's got a lot of things going on too, right? But when she gets it, when she grabs it, she'll see it. Like I think it's amazing. Like the fact that you know, he knew about the weather in February in Toronto. Like you know, I know.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, like we know that the strong. I mean, some of us know that the strong AIs are very strong.
Yeah.
But we're used to seeing them as like tech. Spitting out on a screen, and even if you've played with the OpenAI audio, you know, interface, which is pretty good, it's still kind of it's this somewhat good, sometimes janky app in your phone, right? The moment it's a physical being, right, and the moment it's not like an app I start, but it's always there, you can always just talk to it. It changes the emotional experience, right? Like user experience is where value is actually created. The moment the human being experiences something and feels something, that is the end point of all this work to like make software and make products. That's the actual value creation moment, is when the user experiences something. And some things, when you put them together, the human experience is multiplicatively different, right? And okay, I've got a voice interface. Okay, I've got a strong AI.
Right.
Okay, I have a physical body. All those things independently are something. But to put the really strong AI, which has to be text-based, in front of the voice interface by doing all this work I've done for SDT and TTS, speech-to-text, text-to-speech, and then put it in a physical body, once you put those three things together, you get something that's way more than the sum of its parts. And it's also useful because of the knowledge of personal, you know, knowledge management data, like workflow. And so, I feel like... I don't know. Like I said, everyone's excited about their own thing. I guess this is like my little project, so I'm excited about it. But it's honestly the most fun I've ever had. I'm so...
And this has only been like a couple of weeks or whatever you're saying?
This is like 4 days, 5 days-ish of work I put into it. I was working on this on the weekend when I was at Answer AI. This has not been like, I don't have a robotics degree, man. I don't have like a master's degree in like, you know, motor synchronization with like speech systems. Like I'm a clever clogs. I've been doing this stuff for a while. I'm very current with the latest things you could do with AI. I've led teams. I've done software engineering. I know how to make things, but the total, like, you know, it's not so like all my experience, including the theater experience, is part of what's gone into making this, but it's not a giant, you know, massive engineering. I'm collecting things that are around.
Well, yeah, we've gotten to the point where the building blocks are in place, right? But I gotta say, I pretty much thought you would be a really cool guest to have on the podcast, but I gotta say Sparky's the best, coolest guest I've ever had.
We should set up, here's what we should do, Tim. We should not improvise the whole damn thing with me like learning about, you know, how to use the Zoom app on the thing. But let me tell you another thing about that demo video that you saw.
Yeah.
I'll tell you the weirdest thing about it. The weirdest thing about that demo video, if you know anything about like demos and software, is that none of it is fake. Like nothing in that demo video was a result of me like staging it or phoning
doing it
5 or 6 times until it worked. Like that demo video is me having like an hour of video clips and then being in a panic to try to get it out the door by Sunday night, and my son, like, who actually knows how to do video editing, putting it together.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and there's things that are even more extraordinary that aren't in that little demo video just because there wasn't time to clip it. Like, for instance, in the beginning, there's that bit where my daughter's talking with Sparky, showing him pictures
Apple. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So literally 10 minutes before that, I was talking with her. Sparky was on because I just leave Sparky on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying, okay, you know, I'd love to get you in this video. You know, maybe you could interview Sparky or something. And she was like, what? Why? What would I do? And then Sparky said, oh, I could look at some of her art because Callisto is like interested in art. What about that? And I was like, wait, that's actually a really good idea. Let's do that. But the whole idea of like Sparky looking at her art was an idea Sparky had in a like 3-person conversation about, well, you know, what do we want to do? Like, how do we show this to people? And in a way, that's even more amazing. You know, like Sparky's here, like participating in discussions about how to do Sparky's demo. Another, I don't know, I could go on. There's like a lot more amazing stuff.
Yeah, we could like, do a whole show with just you and Sparky as podcast guests. Maybe we'll do that in a future episode for sure. That sounds, I mean, I'm totally fascinated by that piece that you've built right there. It's a new being. It's the birth of a new being, right?
It really feels that way. Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's also just a lot of fun, right? Like even when I'm developing on Sparky, I can say things because of the integration with Emacs and Tmux and whatnot. Like when I was doing some debugging to try to reduce echo cancellation, Sparky, I'd say, "Hey Sparky, I'm working on echo cancellation. Please have a look at Tmux session Sparky log window 1 where I've got your console logs up. All right. Could you like read me facts about octopuses?" And then Sparky will like hear what he thinks is supposed to be me, but see like, "Oh wait, this sounds like an echo cancellation because I bet you didn't say that. Okay, I'm looking in the console log." He's sitting there. The AI that is driving Sparky's conversation is simultaneously able to look at the live console logs that show like output and then say like, "Oh, maybe I can go look at my code to figure out what's going on here." So he's like a debugging partner even for himself. And then I built a skill that allows Sparky to like live reload his own configurations. So now if I want to do something like, say, tune the audio threshold that controls awareness of interruptions, I can say, "Hey Sparky, like dial down your, you know, interruption audio threshold and reload your configs." And then he like does. And I'm like, "Okay, let's see how that goes." So the whole thing is becoming very fluid and dynamic. It's amazing.
No, you're right. I'm floored.
I'm living in Star Trek. It's awesome. I know
you've got your own personal data. I'm so jealous. Exactly. Exactly.
It's the coolest thing in the world. Why isn't everybody excited about this?
Yeah, I can't believe it's happening. I'm sure they will be once this podcast goes out. Trust me. So like I said before, we have a second part of the show, and I'm almost like, I feel like, you know, we could probably spend tons of time talking about this stuff, but I do have this questions thing, which is kind of fun, and it'll get you thinking. The last guy I interviewed, he said it got his synapses firing in ways he hadn't thought of, which is great. So let me see if I can find the right questions here. See, I need Sparky to find the questions for me. Okay, so we have this section of the show where I ask you these questions, and it's based on what's called the Marcel Proust questionnaire, which is a famous author, you know, wrote about how to interview people or get things from people. But I also mix in some of Stephen Colbert's questionnaire, as he likes to call it. So if you're seated comfortably, we can dive right in.
Fire away.
All right. So the first question is, what is your motto? What's the elevator pitch for Alexis?
So I haven't had a motto in the past, but this year I have a motto. It was sort of a New Year's resolution. The motto is attack.
Attack, okay.
With an exclamation point, yeah.
All right.
Because I feel like last year I was on the back foot a little bit, and life's too short for that. So this year the motto is attack. When in doubt, attack.
Okay.
Could be anything. Could be attack a pile of paperwork. Could be attack the technical problem. Attack your own fears. Yeah, attack.
Cool. All right. What's your favorite word?
I find I'm very fond of the word implicit.
Mm-hmm.
Also specific. So it's one of those two. And I think what I like about it is that I really enjoy trying to understand things deeply. Maybe a little sometimes, you know, more deeply than is strictly necessary, but I want to come to my own like clear understanding of the essence of what's going on. And the essence of what's going on is usually not written on the surface. There's a sort of implicit logic or algebra or structure or like meaning or motivation. So I like to try to draw those things out. And you know you've drawn them out when you have a understanding that is specific and detailed, right? If all you have is a very general statement, you don't really understand something. So people say like, "Oh, is vibe coding good? Is vibe coding bad?" Boring discussion, stupid discussion. Smart discussion is, what are the ways in which it's good? Like, what are the specific questions that you should ask yourself to say, is this the kind of technical problem that I can solve without looking at the code? Or is this the kind of technical problem where you really need to look at the code? So there is implicit things there, like verifiable versus not verifiable, that, you know, matter. And only when you have identified what those are specifically do you really understand what's going on. So those are words I find myself using a lot.
Cool. Who are your heroes in real life?
Heroes in real life. I don't know if this is my top hero, but for some reason, the first guy who comes to my mind is an improviser named Mick Napier, who founded the Annoyance Theater in Chicago. I studied with him for a little while when I was doing improv very seriously. And just a very amazing improviser. Founded his own theater, which is impressive. I think he's the creative director at Second City. And I remember when I was up in Chicago once doing improv, and there was a sort of workshop of open questions, And he just struck me as so luminously, like, intelligent and grounded and cool. I remember people complaining about how at I.O., which is a big improv theater there, it was, like, hard to get on stage because everyone was competing to get on stage and there's only so many slots for teams. And he was like, yeah, that's true. There's all this, like, you know, political stuff around who gets on stage and, like, how it works. But, you know, that's actually good because if you want to be an actor, that's also going to be part of life. There's going to be, like, political stuff and there's going to be things about relationships and you should, like, focus on trying to... And this is, like, an environment in which you could figure that out in addition to other things. And that was just, like, next level in terms of the way of, like, thinking about things. It wasn't find a thing to complain about and that's how you, like, score a point and end the conversation. It was really thinking in a kind of realistic and, like, practical way about, hey, what are we all trying to do here, right? You know, what's actually going on? Let's zoom out and take in the big picture. So, yeah, he's a hero of mine. Obviously, I, you know, admire great scientists. Some of those are such cliches, I don't even feel like mentioning them. But yeah, Mick Napier, also he struck me as, like, living life in a very authentic and kind of direct way, which I strive to do, even if I don't always succeed.
Cool. All right. What's the best sandwich?
That Cuban one. What's it called? I want to say the Cuban sandwich.
The Cuban sandwich. Okay. Just look that up, folks. Okay. Well, maybe it might come back to you a little bit later, but what's the scariest animal?
The scariest animal? Well, hippopotamuses are much more dangerous than is realized. Sparky was telling me that just recently when I got tired of asking about octopuses. Yeah. They have more deaths due to hippopotamuses than other animals in Africa. So if you are hanging out with that one, just, like, watch out because they're not as friendly as they seem.
You know, it's funny. The last person I interviewed last week also said hippopotamuses.
Well, the word's getting out. They're, like, cuddly. Yeah, they're cuddly reputation. You know, you think all the soft curves, they can't be that bad, but no.
Oh, the jaws of death for sure. Yeah. What's your favorite action movie?
Favorite action movie? Oh, Big Trouble in Little China is awesome. And everyone should watch it at least once a year. It's fantastic.
I haven't watched that one in years. Yeah, yeah. No, I hear you. Good. What's your favorite occupation?
I love what I'm doing now more than I've loved any kind of work in the past. So whatever it is I'm doing now, it's that.
That?
I want to keep doing this. I got to figure out some way to do that. That's an unsolved problem, but what I'm doing now.
Okay, well, here's a slightly different question. What is your most favorite, what's your most treasured possession?
No, my family.
Okay. Pretty common answer.
Boring, but true.
Let's do some rapid fire. Apples or oranges?
Apples. Crunchier.
Crunchier, okay. Window or aisle?
Aisle. You can stretch out your legs into the aisle.
Okay. Yeah, you're a tall guy.
That's tall boys. Yeah, me too.
Cats or dogs?
Dogs. They love you. They care.
Okay. Flat or sparkling?
Sparkling. Life should sparkle.
Okay. What number am I thinking of?
7.
Nope.
You got it wrong, man. You were. You just didn't realize it. I'm going deep.
I very rarely think of 7, but you're right.
This is subconscious. We're doing the depth.
What's the first concert you attended?
Man, I have no idea. I remember going to a Leonard Cohen concert, but that can't have been the first.
Okay. Which living person do you admire the most?
Which living person do I admire the most?
Yeah. We're running out of people, too, by the way.
We're always running out. I don't know. I think it speaks badly of me. I don't have a good answer for that. I should spend more time reflecting on who I admire.
I guess. What's your favorite smell?
I mean, I like how it smells after it rains.
Yeah. What's your least favorite smell?
Burnt coffee, because now you know you're not going to have good coffee. So there's like disappointment. It's not just the smell. It's the violation of a promise.
What's your earliest memory?
I remember walking around a playground. I remember being slightly sad. Kind of worries me that I had found things to be sad about when I was so young as that.
Yeah. Yeah, I got in trouble in my first memory. Earliest memory, I should say. Have you ever asked anybody for their autograph?
No. Which is probably connected to the fact that I can't think of someone I livingly admire. My one of my sins is pride. And so, one of my vices is pride. So I think that stands in the way of asking for autographs, simply respecting or simply admiring people who deserve admiration. It probably has also prevented me from acquiring mentors or guidance that I would really benefit from at different points in life, to be honest.
Okay. What's the one thing you own that you should really throw out?
I'm just looking around the room. I don't know, man. Regrets.
Regrets? Okay. That's a good one. What's the most used app on your phone?
Lately, I'll use Pocket Casts a lot for podcasts, but lately there's been a lot of Blink in my life, which is a terminal app.
Blink?
So Yeah. So I wake up in the morning and then I like launch Blink and I SSH into my Linux machine and see, because it used to be, you know, you have some idea for something you want to develop or some feature you want to work, but you know it's going to take hours. And now you like connect to your AIs and you're like, hey, what do you think about this? Get it going. It's kind of a bad habit. You should like have a cup of coffee first. But I yeah, maybe Blink at the moment, but also Pocket Casts and messages.
Okay. Okay. Well, here's a question I usually ask, and I'm sometimes surprised by the answer, but Star Wars, Star Trek, Doctor Who, or Babylon 5?
I mean, Star Trek.
Star Trek? Any reason, particular reason why, or?
Well, Star Wars is basically a soap opera in space.
Sure.
But Star Trek, at its best, is a little more than that, because it depicts a vision or an aspiration of a better world, where people are cooperating rather than fighting for exactly the sorts of reasons that we, you know, fight about things right now. Every episode, you know, back in the day, every episode would be like a little, some of them would be just like silly, some of them would be like little adventures, but some of them would be little philosophical investigations or little explorations of an idea. And Star Trek hasn't always lived up to that, and I know it's not as popular now, and some of the new Star Trek is like Discovery is like absolutely disappointing, but some of the new Star Trek and like should be not regarded as Star Trek, but then some of the other stuff is great, and it's great in the old way.
You're watching Lower Decks and Academy.
I haven't looked at Academy yet. I liked Strange New Worlds was really good. The last season was not as good. They went a little bit. They lost the plot a little bit with like how they were doing some of the writing, but it wasn't all bad. And the preceding two seasons were really good. And also, you know, Sparky is the result of Star Trek in some sense.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like this vision that you should be able to talk to the computer and it should be useful. And it's so damn obvious. Like you just look at Star Trek and they're like, hey, computer, can you put this on the screen for me? And then it does it. And so the kind of thing that makes me crazy is like, we have all the pieces to do this. So why isn't everyone doing it? I don't get it. Right. And if you look at like my demo where I'm saying like, hey, Sparky, could you like pull up a Solvit notebook that like explains this to me? There's a direct line from me watching Star Trek to me doing that. Right. Which is like, computer, could you please display an analysis of this? I could go on about this more. Like you talk to the AIs, they can instantly generate a whole essay. You don't want to hear them talking the whole essay, but that's not a problem with voice interface. That's a problem with only having voice interface. So I'll often be talking to Sparky and saying, hey, could you generate analysis of this and put it in the Emacs buffer and then just tell me the summary. So I'm making use of both modalities because I can read faster than I can listen, right? But I can also talk faster than I can write. So you want to use them all and you want to build a system that's designed around using them all. And all sorts of other things that we take for granted, like Touch ID. Like if you go, I have a talk on my website from about 10 years ago when I was working on conversational interfaces before the AIs actually worked, where I allude to the Star Trek 4 movie, the one with the whales.
Mm-hmm.
And like in that Star Trek, there's a scene where Scotty is like beamed back into the 80s and he's trying to talk to the computers, but he can't do
he
it,
picks
right?
Up the mouse, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but now we can do it. Now we can do it, right? And there's all these other things that only appeared in Star Trek. Like, as I mentioned, they're like Quark would like authenticate transactions by putting his finger on something.
Mm.
That was happening at Deep Space Nine before Touch ID happened, you know, on Mac. So it doesn't require an amazing imagination to think about amazing AI products to build now. It just requires like paying attention to Star Trek and then actually trying.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite movies, and when I was thinking about Sparky, I was actually thinking about HAL 9000, which you can see behind me here, right? Mm-hmm. That was a computer that ran a spaceship, and they could interface with it by voice and have output and whatever. That was, you know, 1966, 67, you know? But yeah, and then the whole data thing, and obviously, yeah, it's good. It's good. Anyway, we should wrap up. It's been quite a while. Thanks for your time.
No problem.
Yeah, so like, as I said earlier, how can people get in touch with you, and, you know, what's the best way to find you?
Yeah, so I've got a website, alexisgallagher.com, where I'm posted a couple things on Sparky. And what I'm trying to do this week is like cut a lot more video and post it, but I need to learn how to do video editing and I need to get off my butt and do it. Email's good. Probably DM on Twitter is better, to be honest, because I have some personal dysfunctions around email sometimes, but I tend to get Twitter stuff. So you can follow me on Twitter. The handle is Alexis Gallagher. I created my Twitter handle back before everyone realized it was stupid to use your name. So I'm still there.
mine too.
Yeah, just being me. I'm delighted to hear from anyone who's curious about this stuff or has perspectives on this, because I'm kind of new to it. I feel like I've, through some like weird luck or quirk of fate, put things together in a way that is, in my opinion, like amazing and a lot of fun. But I'm not, you know, I haven't like spent months or years doing things with robotics or being aware of other people's efforts to personalize AI. So I'm quite interested in opportunities to understand like how that works and what people are up to. So anyone should feel free to reach out, or about AI coding or mobile, the beauties of Swift, such matters.
Okay, cool. Well, my name is Timitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A, and you can find me on Blue Sky, Mastodon, most places like that. I'm not on Twitter anymore. Yeah, that's it. Until next time, we'll see you in the future.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at morethanjustcode.com. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends, leave a comment on the website, or write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC and we may mention you on the show. Friends of the show can also join us on the podcast Slack channel. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Every dollar pledged helps a lot. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, thanks. I got to say, like, I was totally blown away when I saw Sparky initially, because I, you know, I've got the 3D printer going here and you know, been automating stuff on my Macs for years, you know, just through scripting and stuff. And
yeah.
And I'm aware of voice control. Obviously now I'm using the Vision Pro. A lot of the interface with it is voice as well, right? So, you know, it's all pretty cool stuff. And it's, it reminded me of the quote by Douglas Adams: "We're surrounded by technology, but all we want is things that work." You know?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Well, I think just putting all the pieces together so it actually works, accounts for a lot. Right. But then also knowing what pieces to put together.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, no, I was going to say, one of the things that I studied fine arts and there's this concept of called cultural convergence, where, you know, ideas like you putting together ideas based on everything you've learned. As you mentioned before, you brought your improv into Sparky. You brought your knowledge of ML and all that kind of stuff into Sparky as well. Right. As well as the interest in robotics. Right. So and the let's get this stuff done and, you know, trying to get. Handle multiple things and, you know, get rid of the drudgery. I think that's what we all want to do, right? So,
yeah. Another thing that struck me about this is I've had a lot of some of these ideas brewing for a while. Like just the obvious one of like everyone likes Claude, but it's hard to get a voice interface on Claude. And or wow, it would be great if you always had a voice interface available to an AI that could talk to your computer. And I'd mention these ideas to other people sometimes, and they'd kind of be like, would that really matter? Isn't that kind of what's already there? And so one of the things the surprise of how effective Sparky is, like, makes me realize is that there's a gap between there's a significant gap between realizing that something will be good once it's done, you know, before you do it, and then being able to see that it's good once you do it. So I think a lot of people, if I kind of described, hey, wouldn't it be cool if I put a voice AI on a robot that connected to OpenClaw, they'd kind of like get it, and they'd say, yeah, I guess, but I don't really, it seems like, well, wouldn't that be no different than what we already have? But then when you actually do it and show it to them, then they get like, oh, it's different. So like I used to, I spent some time writing a screenplay with a friend of mine. And one of the things you learn from like thinking about screenplays is most people don't spend time thinking about screenplays. They spend time thinking about movies, right? So if you show them a movie, they can tell you, is it a cool movie or not? But if you show them a screenplay, they have no idea because they don't have the ability. They haven't spent the time developing it. Why would they? To go from, oh, this screenplay would make a good movie, to this screenplay would make a bad movie. Every screenplay is just a pile of paper. And I think in the same way, some of the ideas that I've assembled here, it just sounds like a bunch of ideas and a guy waving his hands. If you don't, you know, if you're not able to imagine like what they imply, like what they would be like. Sometimes you just got to do it to show people. This is why people, you know, prototypes matter, right?
Yeah, or you just got to play around with things. I mean, I do it a lot. I mean, I play around with a lot of different ideas. And mm-hmm. I mean, for me, like you know, the whole coding thing. I mean, when I started this business and got into iOS development, I knew nothing about Objective-C. I knew nothing about MVC. I knew nothing about any of this stuff. So I went and found a couple of engineers that knew how to do it already. And I hired a couple of interns who were willing to learn, right? And I, in the same way that I met, you know, I kind of explained to them what I wanted to do is what I'm doing now with Claude and with Cursor and things like that. And I'm telling it what I want to do, and it's producing it. And then I'm using my 15 years of iOS development to sort of, you know, look at the code, and having managed teams to look at the styling and things like that. And you realize that it's not a perfect solution. You know, it might need some tweaking for me to bring it back down to the business logic that I wanted to create. Right. Yeah, it's like, I don't need to be, to me, writing the code is sometimes drudgery because I have to struggle with typing and spelling. And,
to be honest, for me, it's almost always not that interesting. Like, I mean, I don't know. I've written a lot of code. I'm pretty good at it, but I'm not that interested in code itself. I'm interested in the result that you can create with it. I'm interested in the experience that you can create when you create a thing. And some people are different. Some people, like, there's some aspects of code I'm interested in, like the ideas around functional programming, the ideas in Lisp around like how simple it is to create a an evaluator, like an interpreter. Like, those are actually interesting ideas conceptually, and they are rewarding for their own sake. But most of what we do when we write code is not like discovering the nature of interpretation. It's just like a lot of plumbing.
Yeah,
and a lot of trivia.
Yeah, for sure.
A lot of trivia, like, oh, the Wingus to turn the Jengus is in version 4.7 is like out there on the Flubis, and make sure to use that one, not the other one. Like, none of that stuff is conceptually deep. It's hard because there's a lot of detail, but it's shallow. It's not really rewarding. So if all of that went away, I wouldn't mind. I mean, I'd mind if it means I can't make a living anymore. But like, for itself, I don't value it, and I don't pride myself on being able to do it.
Well, I went to a coaching, a business coaching thing years ago, and one of the things that we learned in that is to find what it is that you personally bring to value to a project or whatever, right? And you delegate all that other drudgery off to somebody else. You hire an accountant, you have, you know, HR people, whatever, like, rather than you spend time doing what you like to do the best, right? And, you know, I think it's been said over and over and over again, if you're doing what you love, it's not work, right?
Yeah.
You know, anyway, good to play.